Welcome to London Calling. I'm Graham Mack. My guest this week is Dr. Alison Cronin, who makes the world a better place. She runs Monkey World, an amazing ape rescue centre on the English South Coast, where they take abused animals and smuggled animals from poachers and they put them into natural groups so they can live like monkeys and apes again. It's a special place. She's a special lady. I'm sure you'll enjoy hearing what Alison has got to say a little bit later on. For me, I've had a big week. I did something that means I've now got something in common with 15 Nobel Prize winners. I gave a speech at the Royal Institution in London. One of the speakers described the venue as like being inside a giant Victorian toilet. It's like a wooden amphitheatre. And it was a radio conference called Next Radio. So it took a lot of bottle to get up and speak where the likes of Michael Faraday has spoken. And there's an irony there too, because Michael Faraday invented a thing called the Faraday cage, which is an enclosure that blocks out electric signals, including radio waves. Anyway, I think it went okay. It's on YouTube, but I thought you might like to hear it. I've got that for you soon. First of all, though, let's talk to Darren.
Yeah, he was giving speeches and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, what have you had to do?
Well, when I was at school, like, I've got a school report in front of me, and I had to give, not a speech, but I had to talk about my hobby, which was digging up antique bottles and stuff.
Right.
My English teacher, Mrs. Fife, put, "Darren's reading aloud is of a satisfactory standard, and he has a confident and easy manner when presenting a talk to an audience. I should like to thank him for giving an excellent talk to the entire second year about his hobby, a talk which was received with great enthusiasm."
So you didn't decide to go into that line of work?
I've got a great interest in antiques, and my living room is a bit like a museum, to be perfectly honest with you, Graham. I'm still into antiques, but I ain't got so many bottles left because I had a fallout with the police when they came round one day and smashed most of them.
Oh, what was that all about?
Usual, like, when I was at that age, like, around about 1980, to be honest with you, they didn't like me, and when they came round, they just used to upset me and upset my mum. So I lost the plot one day, and got arrested and was in the Wellingtons for the siege of Sweetbriar. But it weren't a siege, it was just me throwing all my antique bottles of them in anger.
Oh, I see. They thought that you were, it was a siege situation and you were just throwing bottles at them. It was as innocent as that.
Yeah.
Oh, what's the world come to? What's the world come to, Darren, when you can't throw a few bottles at a few policemen without being accused of staging a siege?
Well, they shouldn't come round and upset me then, should they, at the end of the day?
Yeah.
They soon learned, like, not to come round and upset me.
Yeah, it sounds like they didn't learn that because you ended up going to jail.
But at the end of the day, when I was in there, I didn't get any hassle from them then, did I?
They probably think, don't bother with Darren, he's got a lot of bottle.
Yeah.
Here's how I got on at the Royal Institution.
This is Next Radio 2016 with Broadcast Bionics. Innovative solutions for creative people.
Real people are more entertaining than radio presenters. I'm talking about listener phone calls. There's something special about hearing a phone call on the radio. They're authentic, they're unique, and they're unpredictable. But it's hard to get people to call in these days. It never used to be. Let me take you back in time, 20 years. The year is 1996. The radio station is 2GO on the New South Wales Central Coast, just outside Sydney. For a couple of years there, I presented the nighttime show, 7 to midnight, and it was easy to get people to call in. They'd call about anything, and you could just have fun with them.
Hello, Mr. Macapack.
Who's this?
How you going? It's Greg.
Oh, who's that shouting out?
Well, Leona and Peter.
Who are they?
Oh, they're friends of mine. And they're very much in love.
Ooh. That's nice. So they're all round at your place tonight?
No, they're at Peter's place. I gate-crashed their party.
Oh, and you're using Peter's phone?
Yeah. No. Yeah, just ringing up the bill, mate, no worries.
So you're the mate that he's got that she hates then, I suppose? You'd be your bloody mate Greg, wouldn't you?
It's Rebecca from the Central Coast Truck Show.
I suppose the truck's out of the question.
Oh, good on ya.
My name's Myola Joy Roach, and I'm 48, and I've got long blonde hair down to my shoulders.
Do you have a famous celebrity that you look like?
Maybe a bit like Nicole Kidman.
Ah, really?
Bit fatter, though.
Hello there, who are you?
Who am I? I'm Darren.
You're talking to yourself, Darren.
Am I?
Time I turn 2DO on, you're on.
They're working me into the ground.
And why is that?
Because they hate my guts.
Oh, yeah.
They put me on a show where I have to talk to people like you. They obviously can't like me.
You're going back to England?
Yes.
Oh, my God. Oh, great. Oh, man.
I'm sorry, Liv, but when you gotta go, you gotta go.
2GO has just died.
The reason why it was so much easier to get people to call in back then, nobody could text. Why do radio stations allow listeners to text live radio programs? Has radio forgotten it's an audio medium? Think about it. You've worked hard to get them to listen to you. You've motivated them to interact with you. And when they're holding the very device that they can talk to you on, you're asking them to write to you. How does that make any sense at all? These days I present The Breakfast Show on Bob FM, 28 miles north of here, in Hertfordshire, Bedfordshire and Buckinghamshire. I get plenty of phone calls on the air every morning. But I tell you what, I've never had to work so hard to get them. Obviously, I never give out the text number. I couldn't even tell you what the Bob FM text number is. I never use it. The other problem you're up against is most people don't like going first. You'll notice this today at lunchtime when a fabulous buffet is laid on for you, thanks to Wise Buddha. And you'll be hungry, but you'll wait until there's a queue. Casinos know this. That's why they hire people to play empty gaming tables. They're called shills. Here's how I tackle the problem at Bob FM. Every day when I get off the air, I go through the log on phone box and I look for numbers from people who've never called us before. And I call them back, every one of them, every day. I say, hi, it's Graham Mack from Bob FM. Thanks for calling in this morning. Really appreciate it. If they sound good, I say, how would you like to be on my super callers list? This is a list of people who I call off the air in the morning. I tell them what we're talking about, and if they've got a story based on that, I put them on the air. I put a couple of super callers on, and the phones start to ring. These people are my shills, and I manage them. I have them on a Google Drive file. I have their name, what time they get up so I don't wake them up, when they were on last, what they talked about last time, what they do for a living. And I rate them, and I only call back the ones that are consistently good. The great thing is that after doing this for a while, people hear an interactive radio program, and they call. 2 weeks ago, we were talking about a kid, a four-year-old, who got a child's toilet seat stuck on his head. So we were talking about when you've been stuck. A bloke called Dean called up. He said at that moment, his daughter, Nadine, was trapped in a lift in a block of flats in Welwyn Garden City. He gave me a mobile number. I called her up. I put her on the air. I called the lift company. I got them on the air. Listeners called in with suggestions on how to get the lift moving. Jumping up and down doesn't work, by the way. Last year, we got some phone calls that got us on ITV News. It's Graham Mack, and we're getting reports of major problems.
Keeping his listeners up to date with the very latest.
The road is closed.
A fatal crash on the A1M in Hertfordshire caused long delays for motorists this morning. But one family stuck in the traffic needed to get moving faster than most.
7 to 8, stop the show. We've got a medical emergency on our hands.
My wife's pregnant and she's due to give birth today. We were due to go into the hospital for her to be induced, but she actually went into labour during the night. She's now having contractions every 3 to 4 minutes.
Tracy and husband Gary are expecting their fifth child together.
Based on your experience, how close do you think you are to giving birth?
Well, hopefully not too far away, but not too quick. That's going to happen in the car.
And as the drama continued live on the radio, the rest of the family were listening at home.
To think that it was all happening, and bless her, you could tell as well, she was in so much pain.
Yeah, she was really struggling with it, especially like being stuck in traffic, like in labour, can't exactly be the most comfortable thing. But yeah, so it was just a shock, like we didn't hear it from anywhere else but the radio.
like we're getting updates from Bob FM, from Mum.
Listeners then started calling in with suggestions of which way to go around the traffic. Everybody's trying to help. There was one suggestion to cut through the grounds of Nebworth House to get back onto the A1M. Eventually, Mum in the backseat, pulled rank, decided she's going to call an ambulance.
And that's how the family got through the traffic to the maternity ward. And at 2 o'clock this afternoon, little Melody was born. 7 pounds and 5 ounces. A dramatic entrance for the 10th grandchild. Mother and baby are doing well.
If you want more people to call your radio station and go on the air, stop reading out loud what listeners have written and start having actual conversations with them on the air. And you'll get plenty of phone calls. And real people are more entertaining than radio presenters. Thank you.
This is Next Radio 2016 with Broadcast Bionics. Innovative solutions for creative people.
You know, I think I got away with that. The big news in Britain this week is that the England football manager, that's the soccer coach of the national team, is now the most successful England manager we've ever had. While he was in charge, England never lost a single game and didn't concede a single goal. Unfortunately, he was only in charge for 67 days, and during that time, they only played one game. Sam Allardyce has been sacked. He was caught in a sting operation by the Daily Telegraph. They secretly filmed him talking to a bloke who he thought was a businessman, and he started telling them how to get round the player transfer rules and also appeared to be happy to take bribes. Sam says he left the job by mutual consent and also says it was entrapment. Well, he's half right, because it was a trap that caught him out. His big one that he couldn't keep shut. Righto, let's get to my guest. Dr. Alison Cronin, who runs the Monkey World Ape Rescue Centre in Dorset on the south coast of England. This is one of the biggest ape rescue centres in the world. They work with governments all over the world, rescuing apes and monkeys who've been abused by photographers, who have been kept in small enclosures in labs, and who are the victims of the illegal smuggling trade. They put them together in groups so they can live in as natural an environment as they can possibly give them in captivity. I first met Alison and her husband Jim when I was working on the local radio station in Dorset. Joining me now live via Skype from a busy office in Monkey World, Dr. Alison Cronin. Welcome to London Calling.
Oh, thank you very much. It's good to talk to you, Graham.
Let's start at the beginning then. Where were you born?
I was born in La Jolla, California at Scripps Hospital. I was, basically raised growing up in Solana Beach in North County in California in San Diego.
So what kind of place was that? I mean, it sounds nice. It's got the word beach in it.
Yeah, Solana Beach, Beach of the Sun. Yeah, it is fantastic. And it's every good cliche about a small California beach town that exists. It's sort of, not in it's far enough away from LA that you don't really get much pollution or anything. It's not in San Diego, so you're in one of those sleepy beach town communities. And, you know, growing up there, I was born in the 60s, and growing up there, it's sort of a bit of a joke, but if you're from California, there's like the main highway that runs through that's called Interstate 5. And at that point in time, when I was young and growing up, there was no life east of I-5. It was all just like rolling hills and sagebrush and like high chaparral, if you will. So a wonderful place to sort of grow up, riding horses, catching lizards, running around on the hills in Southern California. It was wonderful.
And what did your parents do?
Interesting. My parents had actually both amazing and fantastic lives. My mother was born in the 30s and was one of the very few women who ended up going in that day and age to Berkeley. So she was quite a high achieving academic, and out of university got a job working as the main secretary on the basically the H-bomb test. And my father at that point in time had been born and raised in Laguna Beach in California, a little bit further up the coast, and was never particularly academic, but had an amazing aptitude for electronics and engineering. And from the time he was a child, was taking things apart and putting them back together again. So out of school, he joined the Navy, and instantly they did well. They spotted his aptitude and put him in charge of all of the electronics equipment for one of the tugboats that had been hired out by Scripps Institute of Oceanography to do all of the testing for the H-bomb tests in Bikini in the South Pacific. So, those are leaping great chunks of their lives. My father also served in the Korean War on a tugboat doing the electronics for that and so on. But then after all of that, yeah, he got commissioned to be the electronics guy for the H-bomb tests in Bikini. So, I've got quite a glowing top on today. But, yeah, my sister and I, in theory, should be really properly glowing. But, that's where my parents actually met, was both working on the H-bomb tests.
So that sounds like they were more into technical things and numbers and physics rather than animals.
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, you definitely can do both. I mean, I grew up in a household where rescued cats, dogs, whatever, would come and go from our household all of the time because my mother couldn't bear to see anything that didn't look like it was being cared for properly. And my father's always sort of grown up with animals and things in Southern California. So, and was always both of them interested in going to the beach and the natural environment and that kind of thing. So not so far off track, I guess.
You say you had a sister, just the one sibling?
Yeah, I have one older sister, Anne. She actually lives in the South Pacific now. She's literally just uproots. For the last 30 years, she's lived in Papua New Guinea in Port Moresby and run a telecommunications company there. But she's sort of just retired from that and now lives in Northern Australia.
So you were definitely interested in animals when you were a kid. What kind of wildlife were you particularly interested in?
From the time that I was probably, 9 years old, something like that, maybe even younger. I remember during the summer, like all I would ever do was as early as humanly possible that I could get my mother to drop me off at the beach, which was only 1 mile down the hill. I would be dropped off at 9 a.m. or earlier if I could convince her to do it, and be picked up in the afternoon at 4:30 or 5 p.m. and spend all day long on the beach, sort of, you know, body surfing or riding boogie boards with a handful of friends who would be down there. And of course, the amount of wildlife that's in the waters off the coast of Southern California is huge. So you have dolphins all of the time in wintertime. There are whales like right there, almost on shore, you know, a lot of nasties in terms of stingrays and that kind of thing. But you sort of grew up used to being around that kind of thing. And then, you know, during the days, I spend most of my time running over the hillsides catching lizards and in particular, I remember when I was young, I was just fascinated and loved horned toads. Fantastic little creatures that look like small dinosaurs. It's not surprising to most people who knew me as a child that I have ended up pursuing a career and a life based around wildlife, because even as a child I was doing that.
And so what brought you to England?
I had graduated from my high school a year early in San Diego, and then out of school I wasn't sure really what I wanted to do, and I figured that anything that I would do in my adult life would end up, I mean, and this is how anal and logical I am, I figured that anything that I would want to do would have to be a business of some kind or another. So therefore, I might as well apply for a local university and do a business degree, because that would be a good basis for anything you do later in life. Turns out I really didn't like that very much. I did really well at it.
Yeah.
Ironically, it was because I hated it so much. You just sort of blitz the studies to get it done. But it was at a university that was really more into sororities and fraternities. And I've never been a great one for joining clubs or being in clubs that exclude other people or that kind. So it wasn't really my thing. And so after even just the first semester or two at the local university, I started applying overseas to different places. And the one thing that college, early college experience in San Diego did teach me, which I suppose is good and is part of life and karma, is that one of the courses I did was an archaeology and anthropology course at San Diego. And I found that I had a real passion for pre-Columbian archaeology. And I was really interested in it because there's no written record. So literally the finds that you discover and dig up out of the ground, you have to piece together to create and understand what societies and cultures were like back in pre-Columbian Peru, for example. And that fascinated me. So I applied to Cambridge in Britain to do a degree in archaeology, really, is what I had thought I was going to do. And I got accepted because I had done so well in my studies at San Diego, even though I hated them. And as soon as I did my first year at Cambridge, I knew instantly, because it was a combined course. It was an archaeology and anthropology course. And in your first year, you had to choose three disciplines. So I was doing archaeology, social anthropology, which is like Margaret Mead and studies of human populations. I did also biological or physical anthropology as well, which is the study of existing primate species and evolution. And that, it just ticked every box for me. It was like I had found my calling in life. I knew what I was interested in. I finally was enjoying my time, my academic career, if you will. It was all good, and I loved studying primates and thought it was just the best thing on the planet. So I applied to Cambridge at that point in time to stay on and take my degree, because at Cambridge, generally speaking, only lets foreigners come for a year,
right,
and pay a nice tidy sum for the pleasure. But they decided that I was involved enough with the other students and I was participating in everything. And I think one of the quotes that one of the supervisors used to me is that they had decided that I could stay and take my degree as a foreigner from Cambridge, which they wouldn't normally do, because in that first year, I didn't create an American ghetto in college. I know. Wasn't quite sure. It made me laugh at the time as well. But if that's what made them happy, then that was okay. Yeah.
So you got your doctorate in?
Well, this sounds ridiculous because I'm not an academic at heart. But yeah, I've got a silly number of degrees. So I got my first two degrees from Cambridge in biological anthropology. So that's the study of existing primate species and their evolution. And then out of Cambridge, I actually got offered for a job. I went on a hunt to try and find work out of college because, you know, what else am I going to do? And applied to infinite like zoos and wildlife parks looking for work. None of it really seemed particularly inspiring, but I don't know if you remember, but years ago in UK, 30, 35 years ago, there was a thing that went down where animal rights groups were condemning all zoos and wildlife parks that were keeping bears in captivity. And they said that the zoos were driving the bears mad, and that that's why the bears would pace back and forth in their enclosures.
Yeah.
And one of the tabloid newspapers in UK had raised £21,000 to improve the lives of the captive bears in UK. Well, the zoos, reasonably so, were quite pissed off at the implication and all of that, and told the tabloid paper that the bears wouldn't see a penny of that money that they had now raised unless they gave it to an organization to do something practical and real for those animals.
Mm-hmm.
So it just, once again, karma was good. It just so happened I was at one of the zoos and wildlife parks that had polar bears, and they were the main animals of focus, doing an interview for a job when they were having this meeting about the tabloid story and what was going to be done with this money that had been raised for the bear. So I was offered the job by an animal welfare organization, and I distinguished between the two, animal welfare versus animal rights organization. And the animal welfare organization was quite a practical one that accepted that animals were kept in captivity, but through scientific study wanted to try and develop ways and means of caring for them in a better way. So the zoos accepted that, and I was hired for the princely sum of £21,000 for an entire year to travel back and forth to every single zoo in Britain that held polar bears. There were 8 of them at the time, to study the bears and find out if they were truly mad. First of all, number one, were the bears mad?
Yeah.
Number two, was there anything that could be done to improve their lives or the conditions in which they were being kept? And basically have an opinion about polar bears being kept in zoos. And that's the job that I took on out of university. And once again, I did quite well at it. I had a passion for animals. I didn't mind standing in front of the animal enclosure for hours on end with nothing happening at all. And I studied and documented the lives of those polar bears times 10 and came up with some quite good practical ideas. The zoos and wildlife parks were really pleased to have reasonable feedback. So I didn't just sort of say everything was hunky-dory and wonderful, but actually at the same time, the animals are there. Let's try and come up with ideas on how they can actually better be cared for. So the zoos themselves then raised more money to keep me going doing my research. And at that point in time, then I got a spot working with the Canadian Wildlife Service to go out and do a season with the Canadian Wildlife Service radio tracking polar bears on one of their southerly populations in the Canadian Arctic in order to come up with better ideas on what the bears' needs were and how we could modify their lives in British zoos. And I went on to then get my PhD on that work based on the bear. So my actual doctorate is on bear management and ecology, basically. It was an animal behavior course that I had to do as a part-time external student, because I had to, by definition, be traveling around 8 different zoos in UK. At that point, there was another 7 zoos in Europe that had asked me to come to their facilities as well. So by the end of it, I was working for 15 different zoos across Europe.
Wow.
And it's true, I had become the bear lady.
And were the bears mad?
Well, what I would say, no, not clinically. What they exhibited an awful lot of abnormal behavior, and to the point where some of them would pace back and forth so much until their feet would bleed. But I wouldn't know. It wasn't just that they were crazy. It's what was crazy about it is that the environments were crazy. What you're doing is taking an apex predator, an animal that's at the top of the food chain in one of the most harshest, hostile, inhospitable environments in the world that are carnivores and hunt seals that live under pack ice. I mean, these are incredibly intelligent and focused animals. And the way traditional old school zoo design worked. You lay a concrete slab, you make a concrete pool in the middle of it, you paint the pool bit blue, and you paint the surrounding concrete white. There you have it. An enclosure for an incredibly intelligent animal. And so, yeah, I suppose you could say that the environment was driving the bears crazy. Were the bears actually crazy? No, they were just responding to a very inappropriate environment. And if you give them access to a more appropriate environment, all of that crazy behavior goes away. And we did go on to do that and prove that in different zoos and wildlife parks. And to this day, when you go to zoos and modern zoos and wildlife parks, if you see polar bears, they're living in more natural overgrown environments, which you would consider typical of, say, a brown bear or something like that, because they need a more natural environment where they can dig soil dens and exhibit a more full range of behaviors than they could on that concrete slab. So, That was my the part of my life that dealt with bears. And to this day, I still love working with and learning about bears. And I get offered sort of jobs here and there to help out with bear problems now and again.
And giving animals the correct environment, or as close as you can give them to what's right for them, that's something that's carried through to Monkey World too.
Well, yeah. And you know, the word that keeps coming up over and over again, we've just started talking, is karma. I mean, it was just really weird because here I was, an American living in UK and quite settled. I mean, I had been living for many years now in UK and had friends, considered it home of sorts, and was working, traveling around Europe, trying to improve conditions for captive bears. And on one of my trips, I got a consultancy job working for an organization to confiscate and rehabilitate dancing bears in Greece and Turkey during that time as well. So I had been working with confiscated bears that had all kinds of psychological problems and physical problems as well. And we were trying to rehabilitate them into more natural environments. And to do that, we were building enclosures for these confiscated bears in the mountains of Greece, heading towards the east of Istanbul, anyway, in Turkey, in a town called Bursa. And I needed to build fences. You're going to laugh at this, but I needed to build fences that would be good enough to keep bears inside. They're incredibly intelligent animals, incredibly strong animals, and not dissimilar to captive apes or chimpanzees. So I had heard about this crazy guy that was living down in Dorset that was rescuing chimpanzees hand over fist and keeping them behind electric fences. And I thought, well, if this guy can keep chimps behind electric fences, then probably it would work for my bears. And I thought, yeah, I need to go down and visit that place. And then, as luck would have it, I got this phone call from a crazy American guy, a New Yorker, so quite lively, because he had heard about this weird American lady who was rescuing bears, and he wanted to find out more about that. So we started talking, and he invited me to come down and see his electric fences.
So that's when you went to Dorset to visit the very new Monkey World, because the park started in 87. So you weren't part of that when it started. That was just Jim on his own, was it?
I was at Cambridge studying primates from 86 to 89.
Right.
And it all sort of started at about exactly the same time. So by the time I came down and saw Jim, it was probably 91. So no, the park hadn't been going very long, and he already looked exhausted. You know, this Monkey World is an overwhelming place, both physically and emotionally on all levels. So when I first met Jim, he definitely looked like he had been put through the ringer a bit. And yeah, was reaching out for somebody to talk to, both about the rescue work and stuff. And, you know, we just hit it off from the first moment we met. And what was quite interesting and even funny was when we, the very first day that we came, I came down to Monkey World, we were sat out on a deck in front of the cafe, and some coffee salesman I come into the park to try and tell Jim about his coffee and why he should be selling his coffee at Monkey World or whatever. And Jim said, you know, I don't like making any of these decisions. I think my wife should. And looked over at me. And I, yeah, I know, pretty provocative for the first time we had even met. For a Californian, once again, it's like he was just typified everything that we would consider about a New Yorker. Just completely full of it and mouthy at all times, with nothing to back it up either. And I just looked at him and I sort of laughed and said, I think his coffee sucks, and that was it.
Like, really? The guy's gone?
He sort of said, the guy, sorry. The guy wandered off and we both had a laugh. And that was the beginning of our relationship. So from that day thereafter, you know, Jim called me, or we, you know, we're speaking to each other every day thereafter. And yeah.
Yeah, I learned that when I first met him too. When you're dealing with Jim Cronin, he has a way of getting what he wants and keeps going till he gets it.
Yeah, always tenacious. You know, we're very similar in that sense. It's having the focus and dedication to stick to something where people are telling you it's not possible, it's not going to work, it's not going to happen. And you really do. And it's like, to a lot of the people I work with now, like, we've now got a small rescue center in Vietnam, and the lady that I have out there as director of the center in Vietnam, I tell her constantly, you just have to put your blinkers on and do what you think is right. You've got enough knowledge, you've got what you need to make the right decisions, and worrying and fretting about what other people might think or have opinions of really just confuses matters. And going by seat of the pants and what your instinct is often a game winner, assuming that you've got good instincts. I mean, that's the basis of it. But yeah, Jim made things happen when, at a time, I mean, when he started Monkey World, I mean, you look back, it was in 1987, chimpanzees weren't even listed as endangered at that point in time. And there were a couple of hundred of them being used on the various beaches in Spain as beach photographers' props. And all of those chimpanzees had been stolen from the wild. They were smuggled out of the west coast of Africa and sold to, that is after, I don't know how many individuals in their wild family groups had been shot and blown away. So hunters go out into the groups, blow away a lot of the adults, which generally speaking get eaten as bushmeat. And then the babies are like the extra byproduct of the bushmeat trade. The babies that will still be clinging to their dead mother's bodies will get shoved into a basket, taken back to the local village, and then smuggled out of Africa into the black market to make more money. And all of these chimps that were being worked up and down the coasts of Spain, you know, it meant that thousands were dying in West Africa. And there are very few populations of animals that can survive such an onslaught. And, you know, Jim was one of the only people who spotted this. He had heard about all of these beach photographers' props in Spain. He was actually working as a zookeeper at a wildlife park in Kent. And, you know, he just thought it was wrong. He thought that he should be doing something about it. And with no money to speak of whatsoever, he decided that he was going to start his own place and that he would go to the Spanish authorities and say, if he set up a park, would they enforce the wildlife laws that should have been protecting chimpanzees and confiscate all of those chimps, and he would give a home to every last one. Not, you know, 20 of them or whatever, but every last chimpanzee that they confiscated, he would take and he would bring to his park in England. And he did just that. It was the days of Margaret Thatcher. And Margaret Thatcher, you know, has a lot of people who like to say, you know, talk about whether, you know, she did good things or bad things for the country. But for Monkey World wouldn't exist without Maggie Thatcher and her government guaranteed loans, because she, into an courage business in the late 80s, she set up a scheme of government guaranteed loans to start up small businesses. And Jim got one of those government guaranteed loans. So he got, I think it was £90,000 to set up a wildlife park. And, you know, it doesn't really go a long way. especially when, you know, if you know anything about Monkey World, we're right across the road from the Bovington Tank Museum. And so there are tanks that sort of run up and down the roads in the area. And the very first thing Jim had to do once he secured a lease, a long lease on the land that we're on, is he had to build a turning lane for any visitors that might come to Monkey World. And that turning lane off of the main road had to be tank-proof. The tanks going by from Bovington Tank Museum would go across it. And that ate up £60,000 of his £90,000 government guaranteed grant was for that turning lane out in front of the park. So that was, so he opened the park and, like, you know, he used to like laugh very loudly, you know, there was, and say there was more wildlife in your back garden than there was at Monkey World when it first opened. And to this day, Monkey World has only ever grown and expanded as per our animals' needs. So if we have to rescue some primates and build a new house or enclosure for them, then fine, we expand a little bit. But never once in the almost 30-year history now of the park have we ever expanded for the sake of expanding or created something new because it's a new season or whatever. We only ever expand as per our rescue operations. So, you know, as it started, we continue.
So the goal of the park was not to be what it became, because right now Monkey World is the largest monkey and ape rescue center in the world. It just got out of hand?
Well, you can say Monkey World got out of hand, or human beings have gotten out of hand. And I think that that's probably the bigger issue, is that the world has become such a small place with international travel. And, you know, with people traveling, so do smugglers. And with almost every black market trade that occurs in the world today, wildlife trafficking goes on the back of it. There are very few places in the world where wildlife trafficking is the main form of business, but there are almost no countries in the world where wildlife trafficking doesn't piggyback on the back of some other illegal trade, whether it's human trafficking, smuggling illegal cigarettes and tobacco, or, you know, smuggling alcohol or whatever it might be. When people are moving shipments of products, often in airplanes or in container ships or whatever, you will also have illegal wildlife moving along with the other supplies. And almost every animal here at the park has been rescued. We do breed a few animals, but very few at that. And yeah, we've been called upon by, I think it's 32 different governments around the globe now, to assist them in combating the wildlife trade. Because, and that's the main reason for Monkey World existing, is to assist governments. I mean, the guys that we have here at the park are wonderful and fantastic, and it's great to see animals that have suffered such abuse and neglect get their families back again and have some normal form of life. But more importantly, we are offering assistance to governments to try and stop smuggling. So, you know, governments can't enforce the laws that protect these species unless they have somewhere for the refugees to go. And that's a big problem, because if you look at the Spanish example in the late 80s, early 90s, what were the Spanish going to do with 200 chimpanzees that all grow into monsters? I mean, I love them to bits, but they grow into monsters. They are 60-kilo monsters that'll rip your arm off and beat you with it. They're just gremlins at their best, and that's how they should be. They're wonderful for it, but, you know, definitely something not for the uninitiated or faint-hearted to take on. And the Spanish authorities turned a blind eye to the trade, because what were they going to do with all of those chimps? And then Jim and Monkey World came along and gave them a solution. And that's what we continue to do today, is offer a solution to the black market trade in wildlife for governments around the globe.
So you've come over to England, you've studied at Cambridge, you've done all this work with the bears, then you've met this passionate guy from Yonkers, New York. When did you get married?
In 1996, Jim and I got married in Dorset, actually, at the local village church, funny enough. Neither of us are religious people per se, but and when we decided to get married, actually, we had talked about going and going off to somewhere like Papua New Guinea, because my sister was living there at the time, and standing on the edge of a volcano or something silly, you know, you either get married or you jump, something like that. But then Jim's parents in New York were getting older and their health wasn't great, and they were quite upset that there wasn't going to be like a wedding and an event that everybody could come to. So, you know, of course, we organized the big wedding and had a wedding in the local church, which is small and beautiful, the local church in Wool, and then had a party up at our house. And the tragic, ironic thing that occurred was that Jim's dad, his health, took a turn for the worse right before we were about to get married. So they weren't even able to make the wedding that had been put on in effect for them.
Yeah.
Jim and I were just happy to be together. It wouldn't have mattered whether we were married or not, quite frankly. That's why I sort of speak a little bit flippantly about it. But it was a great day and we had a wonderful party. So that was really very good. And, you know, just a shame that his parents couldn't be there.
So that was 96. And I met you and Jim in 97 when I was working at the local radio station there. And it was about that time that you became Monkey World as a TV show.
Okay.
The local TV franchise down there was Meridian. They made the first shows, which were called Monkey Business. Mm-hmm. How did that all start? Was that pressure from Jim?
No, actually. Funny enough, it's one of those weird stories, actually. I don't know how much you're aware of the laws governing regional programming in Britain. There's existing laws that state that different TV companies have to, including the BBC, produce so much regional programming. And that was to encourage, you know, local community-based TV programs to go out on the different television stations. And the local TV station, Meridian, was obligated to fill so many hours per week of regional TV programming. And when you're a sort of Dorset or Hampshire, Dorset and Hampshire-based television company, it's sort of quiet and sleepy a lot down here. You know, what kind of long-term programming are you going to make to meet that regional programming? So all of the sudden one day we got approached by, and I remember it well, by the head of programming at Meridian TV, came down to the park and wanted to have a meeting. And I remember it well because at that point, actually, Jim was sort of dismissive about it a little bit. And I was probably a little bit more open-minded and enthusiastic about it because, you know, I thought everything that was happening here at the park was so amazing. And perhaps Jim at that point was feeling a bit tired and jaded, or I don't know, but he didn't latch on to it straight away. And we actually went out into one of the chimp enclosures. We were sat outside inside Paddy's chimp enclosure chatting with the guy at Meridian about could there be some sort of television program that could be made about the work that went on at Monkey World, which would they had to do for their regional programming. And there had been a trend in a lot of TV programs being like fly on the wall, observational programs about either zookeepers or whatever. And that's if the truth were known, why Jim was more dismissive of it. I think probably in his head, the thought of TV cameras following our keepers and staff around in their lives and so on probably frightened the pants off of him, quite frankly. And so he sort of said, no, no, no. And I suggested, and it's sort of how it's turned out, we would do it, but only if they could do a program with a difference that was more a soap opera about the animals. Obviously, people would feature if we're rescuing animals and bringing them back to the park, but the main focus and purpose would be to follow the lives of those rescued animals and how they then built their lives back into their social groups. So really the focus being on the animals and not the people, like the wildlife documentaries that I had seen about Jane Goodall's studies of the chimpanzees in Gombe. So all of those documentaries that I had watched as a child growing up, you know, Flo and Figgin and all of those chimpanzee characters, those programs that were done by National Geographic were just fantastic because it took you into those, I mean, I'm getting goosebumps now saying it, took you into those animals' lives. Yes, this was all information that was gathered and documented by Jane Goodall, but like while you're watching the programs, that's sort of irrelevant because you want to know what's happening with Figgin and, you know, is he going to take over the group and what's going to happen with that? And oh my God, the baby died and the mother mourns and the whole thing. So I was always drawn to those as a child. And so I suggested that a program could be made, but only if it was sort of like that and not about the people. And there was a lot of umming and awing that went on, but in the end they agreed. And the way that we made sure that that was going to happen was we insisted upon having editorial control of the offline edit, so the rough edit, if you will, of those programs. And then we could make sure that it was as we intended it to be and not some weird program about how many beers our keepers can drink every night. And wow, wasn't it popular, huh?
Yeah, just amazing.
You know, Monkey Business, it just took off. And the local TV station was so pleased because not only did it tick their regional programming box, they were getting ratings through the roof, and then Animal Planet started chasing them and wanting to buy it because it had only just gone out locally, and so there was still the rest of the universe and beyond for Animal Planet to exploit. So now they were even making money off of the programs to tick their regional box, get good ratings, and sell it internationally, and everybody was happy. And Monkey Business went on for 10 years before it got sort of a facelift, if you will.
Yeah, and became Monkey Life, and then you basically took over the running of it.
I mean, it was funny. After 10 years of Monkey Business, it probably was time for a bit of a facelift, if you will, freshen it up, you know, new graphics, new whatever. And that change was actually made, and once again, another one of those spooky things. The 10th year of Monkey Business was the 10th year, actually, that Jim and I had been together. Funny enough, it was our 10th anniversary, and 20 years that Monkey World had been open. And all of those things happened in the year that Jim passed away. So that was unexpected and a tragedy. But before Jim died, we had actually already planned and agreed to the change in the name of the programs and everything. So it went from being Monkey Business onto being called Monkey Life. And Jim actually is in that first series of Monkey Life because it was just at the end of that first year. So, you know, you film the year before and then when it goes out that year. So Jim is in that first series of Monkey Life. And then sadly, after that first series, yeah, he passed away.
Was there a moment, even for a second, when you thought, that's it, I'm out, someone else can run this park?
Yes and no. There was definitely not just even a moment, but a period of time, not that long, when my suggestion to Jim, because we were actually, due to circumstances, we were in Australia when he actually got diagnosed with primary liver cancer. And that, the Aussie doctor, you've got to love them. They're so blunt. I mean, which I guess in the end, if you're going to have horrific news, I'd rather have somebody just get it out there rather than beating around the bush about it. But the guy came, you know, into the office and said, there's a massive tumor on your liver, mate, looks grim. And there was, we had to get back from Australia and deal with things and all of that. And there was a point in time when I suggested to Jim that we just blow off everything and go to like India somewhere where there's no primates and people might not know who we are or what we did or anything, and that we both just go together in some outrageous wild party and we would go together. You know, we were that close that it seemed like a reasonable thing. But Ah, you're very bad, Grandma.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean this to be upset.
At that point in time, Jim made me swear that not only would we not be doing that, but that I would come back and stick with everything and do what I needed to do. And he was right. He was totally right, because the one focus that I had in life was the park and the animals, and that's what I needed to recover.
And at that time, we've talked about karma a lot, though, but there was a little chap who needed you. That must have been, I don't know, therapeutic.
Well, the whole park is. I mean, at that point in time, I know what you're talking about. I had been hand-rearing a baby woolly monkey that, you know, still needed care and attention and all of that. And that's very special. And yeah, but all of the animals here at the park, because they've been rescued from such extreme circumstances, you know, they need your attention and care all of the time. So it wasn't like there was any doubt in my mind. Like, you know, you come back, because Jim actually passed away in New York City, which in hindsight was a good thing, because his family was around. So that was nice. But I came back to UK, and, you know, it was going to be hard to sort of pick up the pieces and get on with life. But the park and the animals that need you, and you have to get over yourself, quite frankly. And I still, to this day, as you've just witnessed in this very short interview, I can swing from being wildly practical and eminently sensible about the whole thing, because, quite frankly, hideous things happen to all kinds of people every day, every second on the planet. And who am I to feel so hard done by, tragic or upset? I'm just another statistic, if you will. So I should probably suck it up and get over myself. And then you can swing to 30 seconds later to blubbing like a baby. So, yeah, you get the full range. And the one thing that I have learned, which sounds a bit like Forrest Gump, one thing that I have learned is that everybody deals with grief and very emotional things like that in very unique ways. And everybody has their own path to find in that. And, yeah, I would have happily sort of gone with Jim, but at the same time, quite right that I'm here to carry on his mission and his, you know, passion and what he wanted to achieve here. And that's what we're doing to this day. I mean, things don't change, and we're considered a little bit unique and out there in the zoological world, because, you know, we've got 57 chimpanzees on site right now. There's not another zoo or wildlife park on the planet that would think that having that many chimpanzees is a good idea. And to boot, all of ours come with physical and psychological problems from being traumatized and smuggled. And, you know, it's not easy, but we give them everything that they need to get their lives back together again. And, you know, that's sort of what keeps you going, whether it's a good time or a bad time.
Alison, thanks for talking to me. Monkey World is the largest monkey and ape rescue centre in the world. The TV show Monkey Life is on in over 140 countries. What's next?
Well, the park carries on. Sadly, the global trade in wildlife illegally just marches on. It doesn't stop. And actually, as the natural areas where these primates come from get smaller and smaller, the greatest threat to most non-human primates is destruction of habitat. And as the forests get smaller and smaller, as human populations exploit them or take them down for building agricultural crops, whether it's palm oil plantations or otherwise, you know, there's no room left for these primates to live in their natural habitat. So they are very vulnerable to hunters and poachers, and we're getting calls from around the globe to take even a greater number of species than we ever have. So right now, sitting on my desk, I mean, I can flick through it right now. I've got 5 slow loris that were confiscated as part of the black market trade in Hong Kong that are coming to the park to be rehabilitated. I've got a partially paralyzed chimp that I'm working on getting here. There's another young chimpanzee in Kurdistan held Iraq that I've been asked to take that's on the Turkish-Syrian border. So a little bit of a ropey place for this young chimp to be, let alone for people. I've got another orphan baby orangutan to bring over from Moscow Zoo in the coming weeks. 5 months old, her name's Lauren. And I've got two stumptail macaques that are in Belgium waiting for us to come pick them up right now as well. And that's not talking about the infinite number of small monkeys that are part of a legal trade in primates as pets in Britain today. So, no, I always sort of say, oh, it'll calm down and I'll be able to catch up with all of this other stuff that's on my desk, or I'll be able to get a minute to... It never happens. It just keeps... And you know, I really feel happy and passionate about what we do here at the park, but at the same time, it really is a double-edged sword, because as fast as we can give animals their lives back again or protect a handful of endangered species, my waiting list just keeps growing and growing and getting larger. So I guess I would hope that people would start spending as much effort trying to protect and save natural environments as they are destroying them. But I'm not terribly hopeful, because in the years that we've been doing this, and next year we're coming up to our 30th anniversary, the trade only seems to be increasing, really.
And personally, you've met a fabulous new fella, Alan, and he's working out with the park as well, and it was lovely to see you. It's getting on for nearly 3 years ago now was the last time I saw you. We were down there, so we hope we get down there again and we see you all again.
Well, I'll definitely expect to see you certainly by next year on the 30th, Graham.
I hope so. I hope we're there. Dr. Alison Cronin, thank you for your time and thanks for being on London Calling.
Of course. Thanks a lot, Graham.
Dr. Alison Cronin. My guest next week is another American who lives in Britain. He's a broadcaster. In fact, he's more than that. He's an icon of British broadcasting. He's worked on BBC and commercial, radio and television for over 40 years. He was born in the Bronx, New York, and grew up in Connecticut. He's got an amazing story. And before he was a broadcaster, he was a writer for London's Rolling Stone magazine. He's met and knows everybody. He drops names like Elton John, Paul McCartney, Sir Tim Rice. Paul Gambaccini has an amazing story. I hope you can join me next week to hear it. Paul Gambaccini, my special guest on London Calling. In the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Graham Mac. If you want to hear more Mac Nuggets, check out my website, which is macmedia.co.uk. If you've got a question or something to say, send me an email with your phone number on it, and I might call you back during the show. My email address is graham@macmedia.co.uk, and you spell Graham like the cracker, Mac like the truck. Till next week. Ta-da.